This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It may be impossible to put a starting date on terrorism. Perhaps it was the anarchists of the 19th century or even the vandals of Roman times. But we can mark a date as the start of the modern era of terrorism.
Well, it's 1969, okay. Walk across the USA.
In the late 1960s, unrest and conflict over the Vietnam War and political turmoil in Europe led to student movements complete with radical fringes. Left-wing militants in Germany formed the Bader-Meinhof Gang. Italian radicals banded together as the Red Brigades. And from the United States sprang the Weather Underground. Weathermen leader Bernardine Dorn released this communique warning of a coming terrorist revolution inspired by the Viet Cong and Tupamaru guerrillas of Uruguay.
I'm going to read the declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weathermen Underground. Revolution is touching all of our lives. Tens of thousands have learned that protests and marches don't do it. Revolutionary violence is the only way. Now we are adapting the classic guerrilla strategy of the Viet Cong and the urban guerrilla strategy of the Tupamaros to our own situation here in the most technically advanced country in the world. Che taught us that revolution...
While leftist groups were taking form throughout Europe and America, other events around the world created an environment ripe for a wave of terror. Palestinian leaders were looking for a new means to wage war against Israel after Arab nations suffered a complete defeat in the Six-Day War of 1967. George Habash, leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, began targeting Israelis living abroad. In the late 1960s, the group launched a series of airliner hijackings and hostage takings to begin spreading their message of Palestinian liberation. Rome, Athens, and Zurich were now battlefields, along with Jerusalem and Amman, Jordan.
Sitting in the cockpit, then we heard these cracks and we saw bullets, and somebody started screaming. And then I opened the door leading from the cockpit to the passenger's cabin, and I made myself fall on the floor and cried to everybody to lie down. They are shooting. And then the
left-wing commandos, who have held scores of British, American, and West German hostages in two Amman hotels since Tuesday, were reported today to have set them free. The commandos holding the hostages belong to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, an extremist group dedicated to the overthrow of King Hussein. If they have let the hostages go...
As Palestinian splinter factions spread their message and their war across the international stage, another conflict was reaching a boiling point. Street fighting between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland spiraled out of control in 1969. A group with a history of violence dating back decades returned with a vengeance.
This brave, noble band of coercion, with terror and villainy prove, that whichever light George's assertions, the rebels would never be moved. Far up in the hills we were waiting, with hand grenade, nitro and shot. And the Irish Republican Army wiped all of them out on the spot. So
the Provisional IRA split from the long dormant Marxist IRA and entered the world stage as the experienced elder statesman among terrorist organizations. Groups like the IRA, the German Red Army faction, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine gathered in locations like Beirut to train each other, exchange arms, and build bombs. The IRA in particular knew quite a bit about how to build bombs.
And the main news this morning is of a massive bomb explosion at a crowded public house in Northern Ireland. 17 bodies have now been recovered from the wreckage of the Dropping Well Bar at Ballykelly in County Londonderry. The bar was used by off-duty soldiers of the Cheshire Regiment stationed nearby, who were among those who died. A disco was in progress at the time.
Today, the Provisional IRA is holding to a ceasefire and pursuing their ends at the negotiating table. The Palestinian battles in the Middle East are with us again with suicide bombers and street fighting. And now the Western world is squaring off against Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terror network. Tonight, what lessons can we take away from the world's experience with modern terror networks? Joining us is David Rappaport. He's founding editor of the academic journal Terrorism and Political Violence. Good evening, Professor Rappaport.
Good evening.
Good to have you. And also with us is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, here in the studio. Good evening, Jack.
Good evening.
Professor Rappaport, we feel like we know terrorism when we see it, but maybe it's not that simple. Give us a quick definition.
The quick definition is that it's people who use violence outside the normal rules we have to regulate violence. That is, they fight outside the rules of war, for example. And when we have terror by states, it's means beyond the laws of the states. So basically, terror really involves extra normal means. And it usually results in what we call atrocities, which produce counter-atrocities and so forth. And the logic of the activity is somehow to redound to the benefit of the original assailant.
And yet there's a political aspect as well, isn't there? Ronald Reagan famously said that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
Well, that was first by Menachem Begin who said that. But there's always a political dimension. And during the second wave of terror, which was the anti-colonial terror, started in 1920, the world, to a large extent, sympathized with, or meant a large part of the world, sympathized with the terrorists because of the cause they were undertaking. And so when you say one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, you're really referring to the cause. You're not really referring to the methods. Mm-hmm. My definition, and the best definition, refers to methods, not ends.
We're looking tonight at very modern terrorism. And at the top of the hour, you heard the litany of groups that we've seen come and some go over the last several decades. What have we learned from that? Each of the groups at the top of the hour has been diminished. What balance of repression and appeasement seems to be most effective, or how do you successfully confront terrorism and defeat it?
Well, one of our problems is we really have no historical sense of terrorism. It's part of our culture. It has been since the 1880s. We've had four waves. Each has lasted approximately a generation. Each is generated by important political events which give hope to the organization or hope to the various groups in the wave. And when that hope is not fully realized, the wave tends to recede. So it's a long process. And what unfortunately seems to be the result is when one wave recedes, another takes its place because there's a new political cause.
But we're looking right now in the United States at a wave of unprecedented dimensions for us and in a way unprecedented in the world. What is the balance that seems to have worked between repression and reaching out to terrorists, or is that the right way of looking at it?
No, it's not exactly the right way to look at it. We first have to understand what spawned this generation. What spawned this generation was the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and it showed that religion was an organizing force which replaced the old left-wing force that you were describing in your setup piece. Mm-hmm. And then the victory in Afghanistan gave enormous hope for an Islamic unification. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what we're talking about here when we're talking about the bin Laden group.
So are we just getting revved up in this wave, are you saying? Does it have a long way to go? How do you see it in a historical context?
I'm not sure that we're being revved up. This may be, in one sense, the last gasp, because the ability of the Islamic groups to take over states has been rather disappointing. The Sudan has been a disappointing experience. Iran is moving in another direction. There are no real prospects anymore. Egypt is sitting on top of its fundamentalists, and it seems to me that the bin Laden group represents a last gasp, which could, of course, generate some support. But I think one has to remember they have been losing the battle in most Islamic states.
Well, take us through an example of that. For example, in the 1980s and Gaddafi, that was a threat that seemed to flare up and eventually recede. Why?
Sure, but the Gaddafi threat had to do with the third wave of terror, which was largely a radical left-wing wave of terror. It died for a variety of reasons, defeated in a number of countries, and Gaddafi himself, of course, because he was so open and public, was very vulnerable to some sort of a reprisal. And when one talks about what happened between the 60s and the 80s, one sees defeat after defeat. That movement was generated by what happened in Vietnam. That is, the Viet Cong defeated us with comparatively primitive weapons, and this generated an ethos that David would overthrow Goliath. Every European group refers to the Vietnam experience, et cetera. And that's what gave them the hope. But the hope began to fade as failures became significant, betrayals were common, and so forth.
Listeners, we're talking with Professor David Rappaport, an expert in terrorism and its history. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. What's your sense of where we are in the arc of this current terrorist threat, and how can we best address it? We're also joined this evening by our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, you hear the history that's unfolding here, and Professor Rappaport's interesting assertion that this may be, in fact, be the heyday, the peaking of the terrorism that Osama bin Laden represents. It sure doesn't feel that way.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I'm interested to ask Professor Rappaport this. There's a view, common view, most recently given by a former Assistant Secretary of State, who said Pakistan has a 40% illiteracy rate, a low GNP, so the mosques are turning out terrorists. There he's making an equation between wretched social conditions and terrorism. And yet, in this instance, these monsters were from very comfortable backgrounds. Can you give us is there a sort of profile of the terrorist, David Rappaport, and is it a counterintuitive profile, not so much wretched social conditions as intellectuals acting in behalf of those in that condition? I mean, can you draw a picture for us?
Yes. I think you got it in your last sentence or two. Basically, these are movements led by people who have been convinced through intellectual means that this is the way to overturn the system, etc. It's like Marxism. Marxism is developed by the middle class, although its supporters are in the working class and so forth. This is also true with terrorism. The groups hope to exploit the political conditions that you describe in order to build support for the kind of state that they are looking for. In this case, it's a state built on the Sharia, which is the Islamic law. That effort has been failing in country after country. But nonetheless, there's no doubt, there is still a good deal of material, human material, the terrorists might be able to utilize.
And David Rappaport, you said that waves tend to begin to diminish when their hope diminishes for achieving
goal.
So how do we subtract hope?
Well, hope has something to do with failure, and also has something to do with the alternative means that you provide. And in this particular case, of course, what we are trying to do, or at least as I understand the administration policy, is to divide the group from its potential population by offering aid and so forth. But basically, I think the group has to wear itself out. It may be that this act will bring much more support, many more volunteers than we think.
David Rappaport, let us come back to that.
Yeah.
We're talking about global terrorism, its roots, its history, and what we've seen as successful models for defeating it. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. or get into the conversation online, log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. What's your experience with terrorism? It's touched many lands over many years. Has it touched yours? And now that it's touched America, are you confident we can beat it? How will we do it? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this evening about global terrorism, how terrorist organizations are formed, financed, feared, and in some cases, finally crushed. For lasting peace, do terrorist leaders need to be heard or annihilated? And with America now terrorists' huge target, can Americans feel safe anywhere in the world? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. We're talking with Professor David Rappaport, a terrorism expert from UCLA, and with our news analyst, Jack Beatty. We're also joined now by Professor Leonard Weinberg from the University of Nevada. Professor Weinberg is a professor of political science and has served as a consultant to the United Nations Office for the Prevention of Terrorism. Good evening, Professor Weinberg.
Well, good evening to you.
We know you have a special expertise in the history of the Red Brigade in Italy. In brief, where did the Red Brigade come from, and more importantly, how did Italy crush them?
Okay, well, the Red Brigades emerged in the early 1970s from largely student radicals, but also some workers in northern industrial cities of Italy, Turin and Milan in particular. The Italian case, I think, is exceptionally interesting, if I can go on a little bit, in the sense that Italy was able to defeat the Red Brigades without doing serious damage to its parliamentary and democratic institutions.
We'd like to follow that path.
Right. Well, the way the Italians did it, and I may refer to Rappaport's argument about hope, the way the Italians eventually did it was by encouraging defections within the Red Brigade organization, making it relatively easy for brigadisti to exit the organization by passing what in Italian was known as the law governing the pentiti, or repentance. That is to say, by the late 1970s, the Italian government passed a law that provided for either reduced sentence or no sentence at all for members of the Red Brigades who came forward and disassociated themselves from the group. And
so they could repent, as you say, and be forgiven.
Kind of a religious term, but mm-hmm. What we would call in the United States would say was you know, turn state's evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And the effect of that was to bring out one or two repentants or pentiti who would then provide information concerning the whereabouts and activities of their former associates, etc., and that had a cascade effect. So one strategy, very effective on the part of the Italian government, was to provide an exit strategy or an exit tactic for members of the organization.
So
there was also a stick element by the late 1970s. It was becoming increasingly clear to the members of the Red Brigade organization that they lost hope, that they saw themselves as increasingly isolated within the Italian population, their ostensible supporters or audience of working class Italians seemed indifferent or hostile to their activities, and so they found themselves caught between fading hopes on the one hand and the opportunity to down the road to return to a normal life.
Professor Weinberg, you know, is it important in that dynamic that it all took place within the context of Italian culture? Now we're facing Osama bin Laden in a very different culture. I doubt many Americans would be in a great move to forgive and forget and embrace them to come and live in Miami. Does that make
probably not. But there is some sense of, I mean, the scale is vastly different. The Red Brigades killed probably a couple hundred people versus the enormous casualties piled up by the bin Laden.
So what can you...
Nonetheless, there is some evidence accumulated, for example, by Jessica Stern at the Kennedy School and elsewhere, that even the most ostensibly the most religiously fanatic terrorists are responsive to material or monetary incentives. I mean, one member of the Bin Laden organization who defected and is cooperating with the American authorities did so as over falling out over money.
Professor Weinberg, the Red Brigades overstepped, I guess, when they killed Aldo Moro, and that's what brought the full effort of Italy down on taking them apart. Is it possible that Osama bin Laden may have just had his big overstepping in the attacks on September 11th?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on a kind of a crucial dynamic that until the time of the kidnapping of the former Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro in 1978, the government tended to regard the terrorists as an annoyance, a problem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But after Moro was kidnapped and subsequently killed, the state saw the Red Brigades and similar revolutionary organizations as a moral threat to the state, and from a relatively modest priority, defeating the terrorists rose to the very top of the policy agenda. And so you have the reorganization of the security agencies, the defense and intelligence agencies in Italy. A man by the name of Dalla Chiesa was appointed a very shrewd Carabinieri general, Dalla Chiesa. Was appointed with a specific task of defeating the Red Brigade.
And we see our parallel now with the U.S. government restructuring itself to address these new threats abroad and at home. Professor Weinberg, one moment. Professor Weinberg, we want to thank you for coming on and giving us the Red Brigade story. Professor Weinberg, Leonard Weinberg is professor of political science at the University of Nevada. David Rappaport, did I hear you in the background there?
You surely did. And I obviously agree with my friend Leonard Weinberg, but I would like to add, and it's relevant to the situation here, that it took time in the sense that the group itself became demoralized and partly as a consequence of the split after the Moro assassination or the Moro murder. It is very important when a group begins to lose its members publicly.
And demoralizing the rest of the terrorist organization,
right,
you mean?
That's right. And that's what happened to many left-wing groups.
So how do we create an exit strategy for members of Al-Qaeda?
Well, I sense this in the administration's policy, though I'm not privy to it. You do it with Muslim clerics, et cetera. You've got to have people talk to them about the nature of the activity and its relationship to the Islamic tradition and so forth.
Jack Beatty, do you see the Bush administration preparing the kind of psychological path that might be an out for members of Al-Qaeda, or at least a context for others to reject them?
Well, I think the president in his speech of a couple of weeks ago tried to do that when he said that this isn't the real Islam that did this atrocity. This is worse than heresy. This is a betrayal of the faith. And he was trying to distinguish between the vast mass of believing Muslims who regard this with horror and this hardcore terrorist unit. And I think that's an important step to doing just that, to trying to neutralize and as it were, psychologically prepare this differentiation, and perhaps even to promote a debate within the Muslim world about, say, suicide bombers, about Israel, and about this atrocity.
And David Rappaport, do you think we can reach a group like Al-Qaeda from the distance of the presidential podium in the Capitol building?
No, not from the presidential podium, but the president obviously sets policy, et cetera. Our initial problems have to do with very primitive security,
at the airports, et cetera, and very bad intelligence, which really depends on electronic stuff. And we have, these are difficult movements to infiltrate, et cetera, but we haven't made the efforts that we could make. It will take time, and it will take some reaction in the Islamic world. I don't know that it's going to happen, but I do believe the president is attempting that. And in that sense, I mean, it seems to be a much more sophisticated policy than some of us thought would emerge from this compared to the way we've treated terrorists in the past.
I may be wrong
about this, but I think the administration should be given some points.
And to date, the administration is earning day by day more credit for the way they're laying out this scenario. On the other hand, are there not still risks here? Jack Beatty, we're going after Osama bin Laden. We've said that again and again. Yet we've seen that in no inconsiderable part of the Muslim world, he's revered in many quarters. Do we risk creating a martyr who then, even after his death, adds fuel to this fire?
Well, I think that depends crucially on the logic that Professor Rappaport set out, that is to say, the dialectic between atrocity and counter-atrocity. The counter-atrocity managed by this alliance has got to be discreet, and it's got to be able to be sold to people as the necessary price to get this person, because if the counter-atrocity is perceived in those terms, then in fact from his grave, bin Laden will have triumphed.
What about martyrs in other settings over the years? I'm thinking about Bobby Sands in particular.
Yes, in the Irish situation, I mean, that was a deliberate tactic to sort of use the body as to transfigure politics in death. And it harked back to the Irish tradition of the beginning of the Irish Rebellion in the 1900s. And it was a very effective method for derailing any chance for a decade or more of peace in Northern Ireland.
And after his death, of course, there was terrible rioting. We have some tape that brings that back to mind.
Now moved to the Springfield Road, just up from the Falls Road, where there's a group of army vehicles across the road. The place is strewn with glass everywhere. And a few petrol bombs have been thrown at the other side of the barricade. I can hear soldiers firing.
Ireland, in the wake of the death of Bobby Sands and the rioting that followed. We're joined now by Kevin Cullen. Kevin is a reporter for the Boston Globe. He's covered Northern Ireland for 15 years. Good evening, Kevin.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, good to hear your voice.
Same here.
Kevin, we're looking at terrorism tonight, many examples of it across space and time, and trying to think what lessons we can take away. The IRA has become a much less violent threat recently than it was for many years. When you look at that from your experience over time, how was that accomplished, and what lessons can we take from that to our current terrorist crisis?
Well, I think the perfect segue is what you and Jack were just talking about, Bobby Sands, because that began it in the sense that after Bobby Sands died, and more importantly, the way the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher at the time handled it, Sinn Féin, the political representatives of the IRA, were able to maximize their political leverage. They got 9% of the vote in Northern Ireland, and that sent shockwaves through Ireland and Britain. And But at the same time, it did not build on that support. It was a visceral support, an emotional support. But by the mid-80s, even Margaret Thatcher was led to believe that something had to be done. And with the urging of Tip O'Neill to Ronald Reagan and then Ronald Reagan to Margaret Thatcher agreed to go into a partnership with the Republic of Ireland. And the two governments began the peace process literally in 1985 with the Anglo-Irish Agreement, in which the two governments pledged to address this more or less as a political issue. I think there was an acknowledgement there that the security crackdown over the years was not working. The IRA never had a shortage of volunteers. It could send generation after generation to prison or to early graves, and they would keep coming. It wasn't until the British addressed this as a political issue as opposed to a security issue that we began what is still now going on, the peace process.
But they had a political context in which to address it, one that's not quite as easily apparent in Afghanistan or in some of the lower ranks of societies where Osama bin Laden has support.
Absolutely, and that's, I think, a crucial difference, and we should not draw too many parallels here, because the interesting thing is that the IRA had very many connections in the Middle East. I personally know IRA men who trained in camps in Libya, and it was Muammar Gaddafi who supplied the IRA with Semtex and with weapons that really allowed the IRA to accelerate the war and to basically bring the British to the negotiating table and allow the IRA to eventually get there in the later 90s. So it's interesting there. But the IRA connections with groups like, say, the Palestinians, the PLO, you'll find in places like Belfast, you'll find graffiti making references to the PLO, to the ANC, to the Basque. In Spain and France, in the sense that the IRA connects with these people because their single issue, their agenda is very narrow. It's about land. It's about nationality. But the IRA would have no truck with the people that did what they did on September 11th. And, in fact, in a very extraordinary statement, the IRA renounced what was done on September 11th. This is a group that has ruthlessly murdered, you know, many, many people over the years, ruthlessly murdered, you know, men in front of their families, has killed children often by mistake, has done things, but even they look at what happened on September 11th and say, hey, that's not us.
Just too much. Kevin, give us a sense of the material ramifications of that terrorist network or community you describe. The IRA was even active in Colombia, I think, with the FARC there. Is there a sharing of expertise, and how widely does that extend?
Yeah, like I said, the IRA trained fairly extensively in the Middle East during the 80s particularly, and there were three reputed IRA men and people with Sinn Féin links who were arrested in Colombia just last month, and it's a major political issue because it's unclear at this point whether they were sanctioned, whether they were over there as IRA members, or whether they were over there as freelance consultants sort of selling their expertise in urban guerrilla warfare, or whether in fact they claim they were just tourists. I don't know, a lot of people would buy that one. But frankly, you know, these links do extend, and like I said, the FARC would be a classic where the IRA would be in sympathy, or they would argue empathy with them.
In Colombia.
In Colombia, yes. And that is, but that's the difference between these individual groups that have very narrow agendas that are generally based on land and nationality issues, whereas Al-Qaeda and what we're talking about with bin Laden is really a rejection of society. They are rejecting Western society as a whole. So the IRA would draw a line somewhere, and clearly they're drawing a line for political reasons too, because you know the U.S. administration, particularly the Clinton administration, but to give them credit, the Bush administration have sort of stayed the course. There's been a lot of support from America for the peace process in Ireland. In fact, it would not have happened without American support.
Kevin Cullen, we've got to take a break. We're going to say goodbye to you now, and thank you very much for coming on this evening. Kevin Cullen covers Northern Ireland for the Boston Globe. We're talking about global terrorism. How can we get a handle on it? How can we understand it? There have been successive waves, and we're looking at a big one right now. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or get into the conversation online. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. There's a lot going on in those forums. You'll see many interesting opinions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. On September 11th, America and the world watched the terrorist attack unfold in New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington. In 1972, it was the Summer Olympic Games in Munich, Germany.
This is ABC.
I'm Jim McKay speaking to you live at this moment from ABC headquarters, Munich, West Germany. The Olympics of Serenity have become the one thing the Germans didn't want them to be, the Olympics of Terror. Peter Jennings is inside the village and is observing this with the naked eye. Peter?
Jim, I am almost directly over the Israeli building. It does appear to be confirmed that these guerrillas are from one of the very extreme left-wing groups, a group called Black September.
11 members of the Israeli Olympic team were killed in the 1972 hostage incident. We're talking this evening about global terrorism with our news analyst Jack Beatty and David Rappaport, founding editor of the journal Terrorism and Political Violence. Listeners, should we negotiate with or destroy terrorist networks? Join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. David Rappaport, that for people Americans, that piece of tape brings back maybe the first big loud gong of terrorism that came into their lives. In the same way that the World Trade Center was a symbol of American enterprise, the Olympics are a symbol of the human spirit, and that attack was so shocking. How has terrorism seeped into our modern consciousness, and more importantly, have we become better at policing it and preventing it since 1972?
Well, put it this way, the groups that were active then are really not active now. We've got a new set of groups. And I think that's one indication that there has been some success. We can get ourselves in a very difficult position if we just assume, as the previous speaker did, that groups like the IRA, et cetera, are different than Al-Qaeda because they have political objectives and the Muslims do not. That is not true. Hmm. They have specified their objective for quite some time, their initial objective, which is to get American troops out of the Holy Land, Saudi Arabia. And
so we're tempted to see it as an alien force because it's further from the U.S. and because the scale of destruction is so great. But you're saying maybe it's not so different.
Well, it is different, but it isn't that so different that you can't learn anything from the past about infiltration, about turning people around.
Professor Rappaport, let's go to a caller. Ted is okay. On the line. Ted, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're well, thanks, Ted.
I guess my question is, or sort of a statement is, there's a theory of diminishing expectations. There's also a theory of rising expectations.
In what regard, Ted?
Well, I think, you know, as you say, you look at the SDS in the United States, or you look at the Red Army, and you look at the population in general, you have to say, especially the population of young men between the age of 15 and 30, you have to say, how are they looking at life? Do they have a diminishing expectation? Do they see that things are getting worse and there really isn't a way out?
You think
Or do they say, you know, things are getting better? And I think you can eliminate bin Laden, but as long as you have the sense of diminishing expectation, there's always going to be someone to take his place, that people are going to immediately grasp to that person, like Adolf Hitler after, you know, the Versailles Treaty and how Germany was very depressed.
Ted,
people
are
going to latch on to.
Yep, that view resonates with a lot of us. David Rappaport, can we take away the seedbed of unrest? It's so large. The challenge looks so big.
Yes, but again, I think the point to emphasize is that certain causes lose their impact, their effect. Other causes will take their place. If you think that this cause is constantly going to be reinvigorated, I think you know very little about the history of terrorism. It persists, but it comes in another form. And generally, it lasts about a generation, a particular view. This view is now about 20 years old. And people get disillusioned because they're getting nowhere with it and so forth. But that doesn't mean another vision will not emerge.
President Bush promises a long war. We're looking to see what lessons we can pull out of history in pursuing that war against terrorism. We're joined now by John Moore. John is a former terrorism analyst for the U.S. government with expertise in al-Qaeda. Good evening, John Moore.
Good evening.
You've heard the conversation this evening, and we know that you're aware of the long history of terrorism in the modern annals of terrorist violence. What do you take away, looking at that history, that we can put into practice in addressing this new threat?
I think a number of the comments of Professor Rappaport earlier really touched on it. Military solutions are not a solution. Within the counterterrorism arena, you have a multiplicity of different tools, anything from development aid to intelligence to law enforcement to diplomacy. You have to have a variety of activities going on simultaneously to be able to – you don't defeat the threat necessarily. I mean, again, as has been previously stated, terrorism has been with us for a long time, and it's not going to go away, but you have to try to mitigate it as best as you can. And looking at one of the comments earlier was how effective states in the Middle East or in South Asia have been at reducing – terrorist action within their own borders, that has seen these terrorists migrate to an area like Afghanistan, which is relatively lacking in governance, mm-hmm. to say the least. And then what we have to figure out is how we can deal with this vacuum, this void of governance, this void of control.
We seem to be preparing to try and deal with that by imposing some different system or regime of government there, and we certainly have the military engaged at this moment. Do you think that's a mistake, or is that a legitimate first step in responding?
I think a military engagement to a certain degree, I mean, there's a lot of psychological warfare going on right now trying to keep people off balance as to exactly what we are going to do. I don't personally think you're going to see an invasion of Afghanistan. At the same time, when we're looking at different actors that might coalesce at some point, be they the Northern Alliance centered around the former king, to create a new government, we have to be very careful. I mean, President Bush and others have stated they don't want to be involved in nation building. But at the same time, if you only provide enough assistance to propagate conflict and to throw the Taliban off balance, you're still going to have this chaos there. So it's a real tough question.
Well, you've studied al-Qaeda. Where do you see the weaknesses in this network?
I think the real approach to al-Qaeda, it's an intelligence battlefield. We can disrupt them, but in order to do so, we have to be ready to get into the sewer, as many people have said. You know, up until now, we've really lacked political will, and thus we've lacked capability.
Be more specific. We heard just last night about the incapacity of some of our intelligence forces.
Right.
How can we get down and dirty with these folks if we don't have the capacity on the ground? Or what capacity do we have to grow?
You have human intelligence is a basic starting point, and human intelligence means both creating our own people with inside. The CIA is the agency dedicated to human intelligence, and at the same time recruiting different types of people. And you cannot recruit Puritans. The types of people that walk in the shadows with a group like al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda would use existing smuggling networks, drug networks, money laundering networks, and so forth to support their operations abroad.
Mm. John Moore, let's bring David Rappaport in. David Rappaport, we're coming to the end of our time. Draw on your expertise. Give us your big lessons for dealing with this new threat.
Well, you're asking too much. But I agree with Moore. Basically, it is an intelligence operation. That's where we have been most efficient. The military does have a role to play, but if you're not going to do it with a military expedition, all you need to do is look how British troops were pulled down in places like Cyprus and Ireland, the French in Algeria, etc. It's not an easy thing to do, to go and pick out particular individuals or groups.
What's the closest parallel from history?
The closest parallel? I don't think there really is one.
Mm. We didn't want to hear that.
Pardon?
We didn't want to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, in order to understand history, you have to understand what's relevant and what isn't relevant. And there really isn't a parallel insofar as the organization is concerned. But when one talks about turning martyrs into people who betray their group, et cetera, those are things that are very important and have always been very important. The My own feeling is that we should ask the Saudis at some point to tell us to leave Saudi Arabia.
And then take that thorn out of the side.
Important effect.
Mm-hmm. And Jack Beatty, final thoughts?
Well, on the West Wing last night, Josh said that terrorism has always failed. But, you know, in the post-colonial situations of Algeria and Israel, in Ireland and the PLO itself, terrorism has succeeded in some places. And that's a sobering thought.
Our new scriptures to quote the West Wing. David Rappaport, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
And John Moore, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, always good to have you.
Thank you.
David Rappaport is the founding editor of the academic journal Terrorism and Political Violence. John Moore is a former terrorism analyst for the U.S. government. Jack Beatty is our special coverage news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Earlier, we spoke with Professor Leonard Weinberg from the University of Nevada and with the Boston Globe's Kevin Cullen. You can continue the conversation with other listeners online. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night, we're hearing the voices of people around the country in the form of radio diaries. Tonight, Sasha Harris Cronin, a New Yorker, explains how it's not just about the sights of New York, but the sounds of the city that have changed for her since September 11.
Today, from my window over the East Village, I hear constant noise. I hear cars passing by. I can hear the subway underneath me. New Yorkers forget how much of our world is simply noise. We're all used to noise. New York is a noisy place. New Yorkers are tough enough to deal with it. It was the silence that disarmed us. In the days after it happened, the East Village was nearly silent. No buses, no taxis, no everyday traffic at all. Instead, I heard sirens. They screamed down Second Avenue. We all knew where they were going, and if they were in view, everyone's eyes watched them go. I used to ignore sirens. We all did. When it happened, it took a phone call to make me realize that I had been hearing sirens for 20 straight minutes. Suddenly, that was all I could hear. We turned on the television and watched the world fall apart. We tuned in our cheap radio scanner and listened to the fire dispatcher read off a list of floors where people were trapped. We listened as they moved the fire department field command further from the towers to Vesey Street. How could we know what would happen to that command center? To those firemen sent up those stairs? We watched the towers collapse, impossibly, one by one. And we listened to the maydays from the rubble over our scanner. In the background, you could still hear the sound of the sirens. Two nights ago, I was sitting in a classroom when a convoy of emergency vehicles headed down Broadway. My brain shut off. I could not hear a word the professor was saying. The room went quiet, and everyone strained to hear some clue as to what might be going on. Finally, a classmate got up and shut the window. Our professor said, "We'll never hear those sounds the same way again." At the time, we tried to use action to fill the silence. We walked everywhere, carrying our IDs so we could cross the barricades at 14th Street. We stood in long lines and demanded to give blood and volunteer now. Eventually, we realized that there was no one we could help. I was at a party in Brooklyn the other night, at a loft right on the East River. It was the first big gathering I'd been to since it happened, and everyone was determined to get drunk. The roof we stood on has a magical view, and all we could look at, there's a hole where two of the tallest buildings in the world used to be. We still don't recognize our own skyline, the most familiar skyline in the world. Someday we won't open conversations by asking if friends are missing or dead. Someday we won't be afraid of the sound of sirens. But we will never get over it, nor do we want to.
Sasha Harris Cronin is a graduate student and lives in New York City. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing more radio diaries from around the country. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for next week's audio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. Transcripts of audio diaries featured on special coverage are now available on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage on WBUR Boston.